often people say, I want to have $1 million. Well, what would you do when you get $1 million? Because you got to remember, the lotto winners and athletes, 3 years out of the league or winning the lotto, 65% of them are bankrupt. Because they don't know how to use the tool of money and they didn't know why they wanted it.
Welcome to Dear Culture, the podcast that gives you news you can trust for the culture. I'm your host, Natasha S. Alford.
And I'm your co-host, Jaron Keith Gaynor.
And this week we are asking, Dear Culture, how do we shift power in our favor and own our power? Today, we are honored to introduce Damon John, businessman, investor, author, shark, and mogul. He is the star on the Emmy Award-winning show Shark Tank, a Wall Street Journal and New York Times bestselling author, as well as an all-around entrepreneurial force. But the real story here is one of legendary hustle with humble beginnings in Queens, overcoming challenges and becoming a star CEO.
I mean, don't call him a shark for nothing. Damon John's acclaimed success marks an innovative moment in both Black history, fashion, and entrepreneurship. The founder and CEO of FUBU Apparel began selling his prints and designs on the corner of Jamaica Avenue. Balancing his emerging career while working full-time at Red Lobster, no one could have predicted the success of FUBU, except Damon, of course.
And so we'd like to welcome Damon John. Damon, I just have to say that I worked many shifts at McDonald's at 15 years old, trying to save for one of those FUBU jersey dresses. That was my first inspiration to actually work and hustle.
I never heard that it motivated people to go to work. I heard it motivated people to go to a club, but I appreciate that. Thank you.
We love it. Well, you know, we're really excited to talk to you today because this is a moment where a lot of people are feeling powerless. And you've written this book talking about power shifts. We've spoken with a lot of Black entrepreneurs right now who were excited. They felt like this was their moment in history to make a difference. And then the coronavirus pandemic happened and so many small businesses are struggling. What would be your advice, particularly to those Black entrepreneurs who just started a business, about how to navigate the unknown and to push through in this moment of crisis?
You know, a lot of challenges with entrepreneurs, a lot of challenges with people in general, they don't have financial intelligence. And you have to take inventory of any entrepreneur. You have to take inventory of what's in your control. Coronavirus will come back in various different forms. So disruption and destruction will come back. You know, thank God I went through the 98 crash. I went through the dot-com bubble crash, 2001, 9/11, and then 2008. And so coronavirus now is a different form. Next 10 years, it'll be war or it'll be something else. Something is going to come. And when the things outside of your power can't be moved or changed, you can only take inventory of what you have. So an entrepreneur right now, what do they have? First of all, what's your Rolodex? Who's in your Rolodex that you have, right? That you can talk to and go out, and whether you're reaching out for mental help or you're reaching out because you have inventory you want to collaborate with, or they're doing some things and you've been wanting to work with them. But if you were to call people 2 months ago, they may have said, I'm on a plane, I'm busy, I'm not sure that's my vision. You know where everybody is right now, and they're all ready to talk, right? So first of all, dig into your Rolodex, right? Because you will then see the value that you had added in business over the years. If nobody wants to pick up your phone, then maybe you were not somebody people wanted to deal with. But if you were somebody that always walked in a room with a smile, you were always a problem solver, you always recommended them to other people, and or you were a man or a woman of your word and you had character, they're going to want to check into you, right? Also, now you're going to look at your time. That's also your inventory. It's the only thing you can never get back. Then you're going to look at your staff and you're going to look at how much money are you outlaying, whether you are outlaying for vendors or you are outlaying for real estate or you're outlaying for bodies and payroll. And then you have to look at other inventory. You may have physical inventory or whatever the case is. And you have to adjust those things first, right? Are you on social media? Are you converting socially? Or were you always a person saying, I don't need that because I got a storefront and I got heavy traffic walking by my storefront? But now the traffic that walk by your storefront, they're all in the neighborhood, but you have no way to contact them because you didn't capture their emails. So, you know, what I did is I went out to my staff and I said, I hired every one of you for one reason and one reason only, because you're all smarter than me for the reason I hired you. So if you can't think of something to do right now, then I made a mistake, right? And then I said, anybody got any ideas? One or two people were like, I have this idea. And they told me the idea. And I was like, why didn't you ever say that? And they said, I did, you moron. You were just too busy 2 months ago to hear me. And I'm like, you know what? Good point. Let's do that. Right. You know, tap into that staff, you know, tap into the people you have. And I can't, you know, I wish I could tell everybody it's going to be warm and fuzzy. A lot of people are going to fail now. A lot of people are going to go by the wayside. A lot of people are going to dwindle away and have to go back. And, you know, being an entrepreneur is hard. You may have worked 10 years on your business. You only start to see scalability after 6 or 7 years. And then all of a sudden this happens and we all go back. Right. But you're going to have to learn from it. I mean, this is what happened when FUBU went down and it started to go down and people said, well, it went down because, you know, it started because of 9/11. No, a hot fashion brand lasts 5 to 7 years. We're not talking about the unicorns like Nike and Louis Vuitton. And whether you are United Colors of Benetton or Levi's or a lot of these, after a kid has 4 or 5 years in their closet of it, they're in high school, then they go to college. They don't want to wear the same thing they were wearing in high school. Now they want to wear something that, you know, that they've changed, right? And when FUBU went down, I started to buy and invest in other companies called Heather Red and Willie Esco and Coogee and my other brands. And it was because I didn't just sit there and go, woe is me. I'm the FUBU guy. I realized that my assets were not the fact that I can make a great shirt. FUBU's hard, but how hard is it to put a big FB on a jersey? It's really not that hard. I hate to break it to anybody out here. Yeah, I'm a good manufacturer. I'm a good person who knows how to market. I'm a good person. Like I found 3 girls that nobody heard of called the Kardashians, and I put all my Coogee brand on them for the first 3 years. So if you ever look at the Kardashians, the first 3 years, why are they wearing Coogee, right? So I found the pit bulls of the world and the Lennox Lewis of the world and all those people. So I say all that to say, look into your inventory and really do so soul searching of what are you good at? What got you to this point? A lot of times it's not the thing that you are physically doing. Just like you said, you worked at McDonald's. McDonald's, as we all know, they don't sell hamburgers. They're investing in their real estate. That's why they got the best real estate in the world. And that's what they're doing. The hamburgers are paying for the real estate.
When you said that thing about, you know, not being known as the XYZ person, the FUBU guy or something like that, there are people who want to pivot right now. They want to kind of rebrand and go in a different direction. You never let someone else's limitations be your reality. And I think that's really powerful.
And that's important for everybody. And that's why I wrote the book. Because I did see that. I looked at myself and I said, how did I go from creating a global brand to then being a New York Times bestselling author to being an angel investor to being a motivational speaker and then being on a network show for 11 years. It's hard to do either one of those. And I'm not patting myself on the back. How did I do those? How did Diddy go from being a dancer to owning a record label to an artist himself to eating my lunch in fashion to then going and mastering liquor and being on television? How does Magic Johnson go from basketball? Like, how do certain people pivot and keep going throughout industries that are hard enough to just get to a certain level themselves? And that's why I went and when I put the book together, I also said, you know, if you want to know how to power shift, I'm going to be a student. I'm going to go down this road with you. And I'm going to ask Lindsey Vonn, how does she practice for 4 years just to beat the greatest people on the planet over a millisecond? And she's the most winningest skier in history, men, women, whatever the case is. Or how did Billie Jean King take on the face of sports when they were treating women and LGBT a certain way, right? How does Pitbull get to where he is, Mark Cuban, and all the people I put in the book. So everybody here needs to pivot. And people don't like being pigeonholed, but sometimes they allow other people to dictate their goals. And often they don't know why they're doing it. Are you doing because society tells you to do it? Do your mother and parents tell you to do it? Or because you want to change the world? Or because you want to impress a whole bunch of people on Instagram that you really don't care about? Like, what is your why? What is the purpose for doing it? And a lot of us go through the motion and not know the purpose of doing it. I mean, if I ask somebody, often people say, I want to have $1 million. Well, what would you do when you get $1 million? Because you got to remember, the lotto winners and athletes, 3 years out of the league or winning the lotto, 65% of them are bankrupt because they don't know how to use the tool of money and they didn't know why they wanted it. You often ask somebody, what do you do with $1 million? They go, I want to buy a Bugatti. Well, that's not enough for a Bugatti. You need probably 1.2. Well, I want to buy 10 cars. Okay. Or maybe I want to buy income producing property. Maybe I want to go away to an island and carve canoes for 10 years. I'm going to spend $30,000 a year being over there, $360,000, and the other $640,000, I'm going to put in some kind of bonds and income-producing properties. I'm going to come back after the 10 years. I'm going to be healthy. I'm going to dig all the canoes, save the turtles, and then I'm going to have $3 million sitting there. What are you going to do? People don't know their why.
Black ownership is a big buzzword, but everyone's not obviously an owner. do you think it's important for Black people to think about ownership, everyone, or does everybody need to be an owner?
Should everybody talk about ownership? Not necessarily, because everybody's not built to be an owner. You know, the old saying of being an entrepreneur is you work 80 hours so you don't have to work 40. But every entrepreneur like me, I call myself Batman of the company. Everybody's Robin, but half the time, everybody's Batman and I'm Robin. And there's a lot of people who have worked within corporations and people in places like that who have made massive amount of money, because every entrepreneur needs their, you know, their partner who can probably help guide them, right? However, do African Americans and minorities need more ownership? 120%. 120%. It would create, first of all, less systematic racism, because you have people who are hiring and or in charge of other people who understand what's going on in the community. It would create more taxes and more income. I mean, I think if we spend something like 95% of the dollars that come in, we spend it outside of the community with other people. We're only enriching other people, right? And how can we get the best police forces who respect us and the best teachers to educate our kids and stuff like that if we don't own any of the businesses? And if we don't own the businesses, we don't own any of the rights to speak up for the most part, right? So if you have one block, 10 businesses that are owned by people who live in the community, then you have the right of those 10 businesses to say, we don't want the gun store, we don't want the liquor store, we don't want the pawn shop over here, we don't want the short stay motel that happens to be engaging in wrong activities. But if you only have one store over there and the rest of the other stores are people that are moving, are taking the money and going to their community, they're complaining about what's going on in their community. So absolutely 120%, we need to own more of these businesses.
Well, Damon, as we start to wrap this conversation, I think of Black Wall Street and the fact that Black people, we've had examples of thriving and excellence and ownership. What are three things you would tell an African-American right now to do financially that would help set them up for success? Maybe they're not an owner, maybe they can't buy a business, but what are three small things they can do right now to have that financial intelligence?
Number one, read as many books as you can on financial intelligence. It's extremely important. I'll just give you an example. The average person makes about $35,000 a year. You go to work every day and go to your favorite coffee shop, Starbucks or whatever, two times a day, one time in the morning and then in the evening at your 2 o'clock crash. I'm not talking about later on the evening, and I'm not talking about on the weekends. If you just spent $5 each time you went there, that is $10 a day. $10 a day times 5 days of work only, that is $50 a week. $50 a week, 4 weeks, and in a month, that's $200 in a month. 12 months out of the year, that's $2,400. You would have had to make $4,000 in pre-tax money to come away with that $2,400. That's probably about 12% of your entire yearly salary. We're not talking about if you're going to the check cashing place, paying another 5% for your check to be cashed. That's now 17% of your salary. We're just talking about Starbucks and getting your check cashed. That money can be put away in mutual funds and bonds and things of that nature. And if you put that away for approximately 40 years, it would be worth about $3 million, I think, something like that of the numbers. That's having financial intelligence, right? Number two is try to study the stock market. The stock market has, over the years, it has increased every single year. I know we're going through a bad time. This is actually a buying time. But how do you do that? I love watching Jim Cramer on CNBC every day at 6 o'clock and at 12 o'clock. And then you open a TD Ameritrade account on one of those online accounts, and you play with phantom money, monopoly money. And you just learn what's going on, learn how the market operates. And you play with the phantom money, and you'll see that you would have made $100,000 or whatever the case is off of your insight, because just like Warren Buffett, he invests in things that he only knows. Big investors don't invest in mass things. I only invest in things that I feel if they went away, they would disrupt my life. Amazon, if it went away, it would disrupt my life. Uber, if it went away, it would disrupt my life. Facebook, that has Instagram, if it went away, it would disrupt my life, right? So just like Warren Buffett, you may want to say, I know that no matter how much retail is going by the wayside, everybody's going to always pack Sephora because they want to make sure they get a touch on how the makeup is done, whatever the case is. So learn stocks, learn financial intelligence like that. And then number three is take inventory of what you have. Remember, your assets are what feeds you and your liabilities are what eats you. And people who are wealthy know that other people pay for their assets and they don't have liabilities. That means, you know, listen, I rent all the homes I live in. I rent them personally. And all the properties that I own, I rent out. I let other people pay for my debt. And then I get to write off the debt that where I live.
Wow. Brilliant. Brilliant.
Smart man.
Whew. Damon John. That's why he's still here. Still here.
So we talked about Black ownership, but we haven't talked about Black consumers. What have you learned about Black consumers, especially when you think about how companies are trying to market to? Do you think it's authentic? Do you think that companies are authentic in the way that they're reaching out to Black consumers?
It's so challenging and such a touchy point because Black consumers, like any consumer, they want to aspire up and they're usually buying things to make them feel good about themselves or whatever the case is. There are often companies that reach out to Black consumers and there aren't. I mean, I was one that did reach out, and prior to, you know, my FUBU, there was a couple of designers that I respect that came out, Hawk and I, Plus Color showed me it can happen. When I first saw Hawk and I said, oh my God, wait a minute, you don't have to be an Italian person or French person, you know, doing this, you could do it yourself and empower yourself. But prior to that, all we were able to do as African-Americans to support from afar our type of culture was wear kente cloth. And then I started seeing kente cloth colored denim. And I said, why can't we just wear regular denim? And why can't I put quality in it? And so that's what I did. And Black consumers came to it. A lot of Black consumers, though, we go out and we look for other brands and we adopt them and we reinterpret them our way. And the touchy point about it is sometimes when the brands weren't meant for us, you know, we get mad because then they don't do advertising for us. But we happen to embrace the brand. I mean, Timberland didn't come out trying to market to African Americans. They came out because they were a boot company. And then we'll get mad and say, well, why aren't you marketing to us now? Well, you came and adopted us. You see what I'm saying? So it's very touchy. Then on the other side, I really believe this. Everybody in the world wants to be Americans and all Americans want to be Black. I just happen to believe that. I think that we are the most resilient culture and we're beautiful and we will make something out of absolutely nothing. And we have the best energy in the world. And there are a lot of companies that do want to tap into that. But if they're not authentic or they don't have people who are running the ship or doing collaborations with, like you're talking about, business owners who want to do collaborations and or work with them or are the head of design like Dapper Dan, you know, over there. Yeah, it's very hard. So I really don't, there's no one answer for it. It just really isn't. I really wish I could have an answer for it. But I guess that's why we need more Black entrepreneurs, right? So that we don't have to ask this question.
That is the answer right there.
Very true.
Damon John, we thank you so much for taking time in the middle of pandemic to do this interview.
It's an honor. Thank you so much.
And thank you for your example. I don't know if you know, but The Griot is owned by a Black media mogul, Byron Allen. We are 100% Black-owned media outlet. And so that's why seeing someone like you is an inspiration to us as well.
No, it's an honor. And, you know, I go to Byron's Oscar event every year, and I work at his charitable organization. And Byron is an absolutely amazing individual. I love him.
Damon, thank you so much for being our guest today. And now for this week's Moment of Clarity.
Hi, I'm Jaron Keith Gaynor, Managing Editor of The Griot. In this week's Moment of Clarity, we give the latest news about Michelle Obama's push for President Trump to allow full-scale absentee balloting nationwide during the pandemic, because a lot of people have completely forgotten it's an election year amid this chaos.
All right. So you just heard the clip. We see that this story is budding, and reporting for us all the way from Los Angeles, California, is Blue Talusma, senior writer for The Griot. What's up, Blue? First of all, how you doing out there?
Hey, guys. It's sunny from what I can see from my window. It's beautiful outside.
Quarantine in the sun doesn't sound too bad. So, Blue, just tell us a little bit about this story and what's the takeaway here.
Well, the thing that is crazy to me is that we've been so focused on this global pandemic and how it affects our day-to-day lives and affects the way that we get our basic needs met. A lot of people really have forgotten that we're in the midst of what is supposed to be a historic election year. And unfortunately, one of the side effects of the pandemic is a lot of people do not feel comfortable leaving their houses to vote. So Michelle Obama is the co-chair of this nonpartisan group called When We All Vote, and they're pushing for the Trump administration to expand access for folks to be able to vote safely from their homes by mail, for people to be able to have voter registration online. I'm a big proponent of voting. However, I don't believe everybody's going to be at the polls standing 6 feet apart. Let's just be perfectly honest there. And so Michelle Obama had a really great response to that. She said, Americans should never have to choose between making their voices heard and keeping themselves and their family safe. So she's pushing and pushing and pushing for the Trump administration to make this a priority. Personally speaking, I think Republicans love this. I think the GOP, we all know, has a long history of voter suppression and emboldening voter suppression efforts. And so I'm very concerned about how they're going to come up from the lack of people showing up due to the fear about their health concerns. And to be perfectly honest, this has already happened and taken place in Wisconsin. There was an election that happened recently, and they usually have about 180 places to vote. This time, because of the COVID-19 scare, they only had 5. Instead of 180 places to vote, there were only 5 places to vote.
That is insane. 5? I mean, think about how that keeps people from just getting access. How the hell are you supposed to only get to 5 places?
And you know the GOP has like concerted efforts where in Wisconsin, they were busing their folks to make sure that they were voting. But a lot of liberals and independents stayed home because they were disenfranchised and they were scared for their lives.
Blue, I'm actually curious. We heard President Donald Trump talking about mailing in voting and how he wasn't supportive of that, but he actually mailed in voted himself in the past. What do you think about the president's stance on that?
I will say this. I love that Michelle Obama is an optimistic, when they go low, we go high kind of person. We love that about her. I'm slightly less optimistic. I don't think they're going to listen to this. I think the brilliance of what she's doing and her using her celebrity, because let's be honest, the Obamas are rock stars, and her getting her other celebrity friends to help is, even if the Trump administration doesn't give them their ask, at least the public now has it on their radar that this is one more way that we need to make up for what the government is lacking.
Last year, we went big. Millions of new voters made their voices heard for the first time. Now the stakes are even higher. That's why I've been reaching out to some friends to expand my voting squad for the year ahead.
It all starts with you.
You're the only person
that could have that conversation
with your family and your friends
and your girlfriend.
And even with your community.
To get them registered and ready to vote.
Or just send them a text or slide into their DMs and say, yo, you up? Good, because you need a squad up.
We need you
to draft your own championship voting squad.
It's up to you to change the game.
Because when we squad up,
when we make our voices heard,
when we all vote,
when we
all vote,
we can change the world.
Head to whenweallvote.org
to get started. Let's get to work. Join us.
So I don't think the Trump administration is going to listen because they never listen. But this is a call to action for the rest of us to be like, oh, you're right. Let me not forget to get myself some gloves and a mask and go vote, or at least make sure I figure out how to vote remotely in my area so that they don't win.
Right. And a lot is at stake in 2020. Let's be clear.
I mean, the whole world? Yeah, the whole world's at stake. Personally, I'm going to be honest. I didn't vote in the primaries, guys, because I was new to LA, and I use that as an excuse, but I think COVID-19 and seeing what's happening with the election year is kicking me in the butt. So this is me saying, if you're someone who has been lagging because you moved like I did, or you're scared to leave your house, please know that there are other ways for you to vote that don't require you to put your safety and your health at risk. Please look into that. We can't use this as an excuse as to why we lost another election to Trump. We just can't.
Amen to that.
Indeed. Thanks for tuning in to the Moment of Clarity. And now here is the final segment of the show.
We want to remind our listeners to support and show love to Black businesses, especially right now during this coronavirus pandemic. The business that we're highlighting this week is Stuzo Clothing, which is a woman-owned clothing brand designed to evoke thought and emotion.
Worn by celebs like Jada Pinkett Smith, Tiffany Haddish, and Spike Lee, Stuzo celebrates form and shape with no gender attached. You can purchase Stuzo Clothing at stuzoclothing.com.
Yeah, it's funny. I went to the website, Jaren, and I saw that they actually have a face mask for coronavirus with little Black Power fists on it. I loved it.
Yeah, it's so cool and innovative.
I love the fact that, you know, at a time when you could just be wearing a very basic cloth around your face, Black people find a way to make it stylish. So shout out to Stuzo Clothing for that.
The Griot has published a list of 50 plus Black businesses to support during the coronavirus pandemic. If you'd like your business to be featured, email us at info@thegrio.com. Thank you for listening to Dear Culture. If you like what you heard, please give us a 5-star review and subscribe to the show wherever you listen to your podcast and share with everyone you know.
Yes, and please email us all your questions, suggestions, and insights right at info@thegrio.com. The Dear Culture podcast is brought to you by The Grio and executive produced by Natasha S. Alford and Kevin Y. Brown. We'll see you next week.